Hey, my name is John Cho, and I play Hikaru Sulu in the new Star Trek movie, and you're listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Hi, this is Jerry.
And you're also listening to Eugenia.
Podcast 4.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
That's really a lot, really, isn't it?
It is a lot in a very short amount of time.
But we can talk lots.
And lots.
And lots.
And we're still talking about the Star Trek premiere.
Because it's such a big thing and it's not out yet.
Yeah.
So we've still got a few weeks to go, or hopefully about a week before this podcast goes out.
And it is a big thing. You know, from a Trekkie point of view, this movie is a major, major thing.
Absolutely. I mean, we've obviously been waiting for it for the last 3 or 4 years because Enterprise finished, and unfortunately it finished on a sour note, I think, for a lot of Trekkies.
They should have swapped the two episodes around and I would have been happier.
Absolutely. And I think because of that, we were actually quite disappointed the way Star Trek finished. It was like, oh no, it's gone.
And then, of course, this movie was supposed to be out at Christmas time.
Mm, which, of course, made you think that it was bad.
Mm. And very soon, it's, you know, not many sleeps to go now.
Not at all.
And we're actually going to see it on the big screen.
We are. Well, I've seen it on the big screen. I'm sorry.
I know.
And a big screen. Like, it was a humongous screen. It wasn't even just a big screen. It was almost like being in an IMAX theatre because the area was such a big screen. And that, of course, was at, dare I say it, the world premiere of the Star Trek movie at the Sydney Opera House in Sydney.
So, Jerry, you actually, as we know from the last podcast, you actually talked to J.J. Abrams, but they're not the... He's not the only one that you talked to.
No, not at all. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the last one, I got to talk to lots of them, which was really quite fantastic. One of the, I suppose, pivotal things about the new movie is the two characters, Kirk and Spock. And, of course, because they are basically Star Trek, it would... And I was looking forward in particular to see the two new actors, and that's Zachary Quinto and Chris Pine, and what they would be like in the movie. And without giving spoilers away, I really enjoyed the performance of both of them. But what I really, 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 really enjoyed was that I got to meet up with them and interview them as well in a roundtable interview with some other people up on the 23rd floor of a hotel in Sydney. So that was quite exciting.
I know when I first heard that Zachary Quinto was going to be Spock, part of me went, and part of me went, oh, especially with his role as Siler in Heroes, you know, having that, seeing, I guess, for the first time for me, seeing him as an actor in that role, and then to see him in this iconic role, I wasn't that happy, but
Well,
I'm getting used to it now.
Well, he's such a badass in Heroes, and because he acts it so well, we really dislike him. And I think sometimes what can actually happen when you see an actor in a show and you either like them or you don't, you look forward to or not to their next performance because you think they were such a badass. If you want to put it in that, he's going to be a badass in the next one kind of thing. But I have to say that he did a really, really good job. And I think people will enjoy his character in the new movie. And he's such a nice man as well. Absolutely quite fun.
Now, I hear that you've met him more than just once.
Well, I did. I also got the opportunity to go up and down in the lift with him as well and see me going from the 23rd floor. It's quite a long lift and quite an amount of seconds where you can actually have a conversation. So that was really sweet. I met his brother in the lift as well. They were just about to leave to go to the hotel to get all the stuff because they were flying out to New Zealand so they could do the premiere in New Zealand as well. So I had a bit of a chat with him in the lift on the way down, and that was lovely. But of course, what you'll actually hear is that he sort of knew who I was anyway, because at the beginning of the interview, he turns around and says, oh, I remember you. You were on the steps last night. So, you know, that was quite nice to be pointed out and said, I remember who you are from the media bay when we were there on the night of the premiere itself. Because, of course, this interview happened the day after the interview. And the interview was with Chris Pine, so it's a joint interview, and they were really nice to get guys together. And it's quite funny, in the middle of the interview, you'll hear this sort of ooh kind of thing coming out and a few people laughing. And as I mentioned in the last podcast, they look after you when you go up there, and particularly they look after the actors who are sitting there all day, and they had a bit of a food platter out for them, so they had dips and, you know, vegetables cut up and biscuits and all that. And obviously Zach was quite hungry because he was quite chomp, chomp, chomp. You might hear bits of carrot and stuff get chomped away. And he had a packet of biscuits, and he put the biscuits in the middle of the table in front of all the recording machines that were actually put there. And Chris Pine decided that obviously it was in the way of them, so he took it off the coffee table thing and put it on the floor in between them. So every now and again, as they were having a conversation, you could see without them looking that Zach could put his hand down and pick something out of it. And right in the middle of the interview, you know, you see this look on his face of going, bleh, bleh, bleh. And he was eating, I think, a hummus dip. But unfortunately, instead of picking up a cracker, he picked up what he called a cookie, and we call a biscuit. And I don't think a sweet biscuit and hummus really go together terribly well. So that was
not
actually
a good mix at all.
So to hear a giggle in the middle of it all, that was something that was quite funny. And obviously, the look in his face is quite expressive, as we know from watching him on Heroes, but not necessarily on Star Trek.
Well, you'd think in Star Trek that he'd be quite emotionless due to his role as the Vulcan.
Well, yes and no. Don't forget, this is actually a different Spock, and I'm not going to give you anything away. I just have to let you assume something as you go through the movie. But you do see him as a young man, a young boy, in fact, in the movie, and there's flashbacks, really, to both of them, and that sets some of the story up. And, of course, he's still dealing very much with his Vulcan human side. So that's something that you can look forward to seeing without me giving you any information.
Good, because I don't want spoilers.
No, she doesn't want spoilers. It's a pain in the neck, really.
And Chris Pine, what's he like as a person?
He's lovely. He's got a beautiful smile. He's really nice eyes. That's the girly in me coming out, I suppose. He's a really pleasant, gentle person, very personable, easy to talk to, easy to chat. The probability is because you're in a room, and we were only down to 15 minutes with them because they had a few interviews to go, and there were two of them sitting there, so it was probably a little bit harder than, say, the JJ interview where we were talking to him exclusively, where we were talking to both of them, so we were maybe getting a question in, one would take it up, and then the next one would take it up, and so on. So you didn't get to meet them as much, if you understand what I mean by talking to that. But it was really, really quite exciting. They're both easy to talk to people. Siler is not Siler. I have to say the eyebrows are not as eyebrowy as they were when he first started doing Heroes along the way. And, of course, they've recovered since the complete moving of the Vulcan eyebrows, as they are. But they seem to really, really have enjoyed and really have looked forward to and really understand what they were walking into, because I think they did a lot of research with some of the other characters in the past, not necessarily watched the movies and stuff, but they both contacted their counterparts, if you want to say, and had either discussions or letters with them. So it was really quite interesting to see that they paid homage in a little way to the old Kirk and the old Spock and picked up the mantle. But I think it was probably good casting. I think they both do the job very well.
Excellent. So we're going to hear that particular interview now.
Marlene and Jerry, Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Oh, cool.
Women Talk.
Right on. Right on.
Cool.
I'm Matt.
Nice to
meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Were either of you fans of Star Trek prior to being cast in the roles?
I was familiar with Star Trek, but I wasn't a fan. I was more of a kid of the Star Wars generation. But my grandmother was a big William Shatner fan, so she babysat me a ton. So I watched T.J. Hooker with her. And I think on Sundays there were reruns every night or something. I'd catch a couple, but it just wasn't my cup. But I really didn't start watching it until I got the part.
I similarly was not a fanatic, but was familiar with it growing up, and and then I didn't watch any of the episodes in preparation for the role. I just watched them once we started shooting. Mm. So, and I had the advantage, obviously, of Leonard, who's here for crackers now. This not lunchtime. Anybody help
myself?
So yeah, so I actually really immersed myself in the in a lot of literature. A lot, you know, there's no shortage of writing about Star Trek. Oh, there you go.
How would we broadcast this in a tune?
Chris, what surprised me about your performance of Kirk was the amount of physical comedy that was throughout it. I mean, was that something that was in the script itself, or did you and JJ kind of work on that? Or?
I don't know, I was thinking about that last night. I think a lot of it came out of, there was humor built into it, but it was the extent to which or how far or how broad to take it. And most of it came out in the moment on set and talking with JJ. And JJ's incredibly funny and has an incredible sense of humor. And I had an incredible amount of fun making him laugh. So, again, it was just degrees and talking about it on the day. But and especially, you know, the stuff in the beginning with Carl. I had so much fun working off of Carl. We just had, and you know, I don't know, I think the humor in the film, the broad comedy or whatever you wanted, the physical comedy, but then on top of the fact that we were having a lot of fun doing it, I think that hopefully that that energy translates on the screen.
It does.
Well, thank you.
You guys have probably been asked this question a very lot over the last few months, but are you guys worried about being typecast now? Because there is this tendency with the Star Trek actors.
That was a cookie, by the way. I'm not a cracker.
It's the butter cookie.
That's awful.
And that didn't go well with the
not a good combination. Just so you know.
Oh, that's like an appetite.
It wasn't a question that I
wanted
to raise. I'm good. You know, the typecasting question. I mean, I think I come from now, the last two projects that I've worked on have been heavily rooted in the science fiction world. So for me to go from Heroes to Star Trek was in a lot of ways a natural progression. But now, as an actor, it's incredibly important to me to make sure that I diversify my experience. I mean, I come from a theater background, I sort of, you know, so does Chris, so we both come from the training ground where the mandate was, you know, you do everything. You know, I played a 50-year-old father in college in a comedy. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm really eager to have those other experiences, to invite my science fiction fan base to join me in exploration of other kinds of genres and other kinds of work. But I don't really feel like these characters, like, the experience of these characters, I don't think it has the same kind of impact that it had on Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy 40 years ago, because I don't think science fiction has the same kind of stigma that's attached to it, that was attached to it then. And I also, frankly, don't think that people's attention spans are what they used to be. I think people are really eager to move on from something and on to something else. So it's like, I don't really worry about it so much, but, you know, it's something that now it's our responsibility to make sure it doesn't happen.
So, were you in any way intimidated by taking on these iconic roles? I mean, there is an amazing fan base out there that's been waiting for this movie to actually come out.
Yeah, I was intimidated at first, but and I think it's only natural because, unlike any other fan community, I think Star Trek takes the cake in terms of the passion and protectiveness that the fans have over the material. But it's really a credit to JJ that I don't, you know, I never felt encumbered by the responsibility of having to live up to the expectations of fans as much as we had the fans' expectations and desires in mind, you know, surely when we were making it. But JJ created an atmosphere on set that was really, you never felt like you were making a big budget studio film, and you never felt again, the weight of responsibility. You just had a lot of fun. And JJ, I don't know if you've met him yet, but he told me the other day, he was, you know, we were talking about this whole experience and how what a trip it is to be flying all over the world and promoting it, and he said, you know, I would make movies if I wasn't getting paid anything. I'd make it in my backyard on the weekends, even if I were an accountant. And that's not hyperbole. That is like, that is the truth. I buy it. That is J.J. Ortiz. He loves what he does, and that passion and positivity, and that's the kind of atmosphere that's on set. You just feel like...
And it also defines the people that work with him. So it's like, you know, when you think that almost 1,000 people worked on this movie, mm-hmm. and all of them share his vision and his passion, and he really infuses the experience with a tremendous... He respects everybody mm-hmm. equally, and so everybody respects the experience equally, and it's a really, really unusual dynamic, I would say. I mean, from
it's an unusual dynamic given any film. It's
right.
an extremely unusual dynamic given
the
film this big. And again, it's J.J. You know, it's interesting that the team behind you, you have J.J., then you have Bob and Alex, Bob Orsi and Alex Kurtzman, who wrote it, and they all kind of come from an independent background, or rather a smaller mm-hmm. character-driven background regarding Henry, J.J.'s first script. Bob and Alex began in smaller films. Felicity. I mean, you have these guys that come from a real character, a place of character, you know, building relationships in movies rather than building spectacle. And I think coming from that base, once you add on all the spectacle, it has that much more gravity. Otherwise, it's just, you know, stuff exploding, and while it might look pretty, it won't have any meaning. And that, you know, that's their power.
You've got to speak to Bill Shatner a bit.
I wrote him a letter.
Did they actually sort of like give you hints or anything?
Well, I wrote him a letter and introduced myself early on in the process after I'd gotten it, just to do that, just to introduce myself and say I'm the new kid on the block, and you know, and because I really, you know, I heard there was some acrimony between he and the studio, and I just wanted to make sure that he knew that I was, like any actor, searching for a good role, and I found a good role, and it just so happened that it was something that he'd created and been a part of and was the guy for 40 years. And you know, again, my job was just to do a very brief moment in this character's journey, which is that first part of the arc, and all I was trying to do was add to the you know, to that character's journey. But he was very nice, wrote me back very promptly, and but he was busy completing the final season of Boston Legal, and we've yet to get together, but I would love to meet him, because I love meeting and getting to know, you know, Mr. Nimoy.
Leonard and I hang out. Love him. He's really, really cool. I saw him right before I left for this trip, and just emailed with him this morning because he was in Austin. He was the sort of he was the surprise there. I think he was really glad to do that as well. I think it's really appropriate that he be the, you know, the sort of, I don't know, it's just, it's nice that happened in the way it did, and it's very J.J. that you know, they sort of did
that. Well, sort of at the end of the movie,
switch.
Sort of like said, I, you know,
can be in two places at once.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I sort of said it to Kirk, but I didn't say it to you, so that these two can sort out your differences and build your relationship from scratch.
Yeah, it's nice. It's really, there's a lot of echoes of the characters' relationships in Leonard and in me and in Chris and me, and it's nice to see it all come together, and I'm glad that he had that experience in Austin.
That is really cool about that last thing. I was thinking about that last night, is how human Nimoy is allowed to become in that moment, and how, and I love how his last sign-off isn't live long and prosper, but good luck.
That's right.
A really, again, a wonderfully human connection that was great. I really liked that a lot.
Yeah.
All right. What physical preparations do you guys go through to get into your characters?
Steroids. They clearly didn't work at all. No, we had about 2 months of Star Trek boot camp, which was consisted of about 3 hours in this huge soundstage in the Paramount lot that they converted into our own private gym. And we got to work with two of the best stunt guys in the business, Robert Alonso and Joey Box, and it was fun, you know. They crafted not martial arts, but they crafted our, you know, the combat for each person was very particular and specific to their character. So my, you know, Kirk becomes the brawler, you know, just kind of throwing, you know, haymakers everywhere. Whereas Spock, you know, his martial art is more
get logical and clear and precise and clean. And Sulu's is very, well, he's a sword fighter and kung fu or whatever that one was. But anyway, but it was a lot of fun. You know, we'd see each other for like 3 hours a day, and one of us would be coming in. You'd see like John on jump rope and Zach's, you know, kicking Robert's ass in the background. And it was a lot of fun. It was great fun.
Cool. Yeah, I agree. There's also a physicality to Spock that, you know, aside from the stunt work or aside from the combat stuff, there's a physicality to the character that I think is really pivotal. And it's sort of inextricable from who the character is. So, you know, there's that. And it's a lot about stillness, and it's a lot about containment, and it's a lot about reservation, the way that he holds himself. And, you know, Leonard did a lot of hands behind his back and sort of, you know. So I tried to modify it a little bit, like, you know, also because, you know, the thing that you said about the more human side of Spock, I think it's less to do with the alternate timeline and more to do with the fact that this iteration of the character, he's just not as settled in the duality inside of himself, you know, and so I tried to find ways in which that could reveal itself, you know, certainly after the scene on the bridge when Spock sort of goes and then he's walking down the hall, and, you know, also at the Vulcan Council at the beginning, you know, I sort of adopted a little, like, hands in front instead of in the back, and, like, just tried to change that, but I didn't have that much wiggle room, you know what I mean? There's only so much you can do before it's not true to the character anymore. Mm-hmm. So that line for me and walking that line was always really interesting, and, you know, I love physicality as it pertains to the work, but it's also it's oftentimes on stage it's much easier because it's a whole journey, you know, and in film it's very fragmented, and it's also much more about, you know, from here up. So
yeah, cool. Can you guys take us through a typical day on the set?
And there was not a typical day at all. It's kind of it varied, can be anywhere from, you know, like the ice planet scene, that was a month and a half on location somewhere. The bridge stuff was a whole different era in filming.
But whatever, I can take you through a typical day because it started 2 hours earlier for me than it did for everybody else. What's that? The violin?
It's my little violin. Okay. I should put it back in its case.
Can you make it a little bit bigger? No, but my day always started before everybody else's just because I had to go through the makeup process, which is about 2 hours. So my day, but it was great actually because it was a period of time where I could really sort of center and you know, prepare myself for the day ahead. And I spent a lot of that time in silence, and, you know, the people were just working around me. Sometimes I would sleep. I would, you know, they'd be doing their thing. But yeah. So and then depending on where we were, depending on how physical it was or what the sequence was, but there was about a month stretch when we were shooting the stuff on the bridge of the Enterprise where everybody was there. That was really fun. They were really long days. We would do like sometimes 16, 17 hour days. But
what was really the director actor relationship with JJ?
Very collaborative.
What process?
Yeah.
Well, I think a couple of things strike me about JJ is, first of all, especially on a set filled with newbies in a way, I mean, Zach and Carl, everybody's got a resume to speak of, but clearly we're all in a certain stage of our careers that to be a part of a big movie like that, a lot of times you just feel so grateful that you're a part of it that you don't feel like you'll have an equal voice. And JJ, like Zach said, is so collaborative. And one of the first things I remember him telling me is that he knows that 100 heads are better than one. So he knows that the smarter director, the smarter general, knows that he needs all the smart minds that he can get. And to have that sense of equanimity on set, to have that sense of the feeling of mutual and collaboration was fantastic. On top of which, you know, here's a man who can be on his, you know, 17-inch MacBook showing you, he's picked apart like Sergeant Pepper's in multiple tracks and is remixing it himself, talking to the set designer, or the CG, the digital effects guy about something, and also talking to you about, you know, what's happening in the scene. And a really, in a very present way, his level of multitasking is really remarkable, and I couldn't have asked for a better actor's director. I mean, you knew exactly how to talk to us, I think.
Yeah, I concur completely. He's, he's a magician, you know. He does magic tricks on set sometimes, truly. but also just it's really unfathomable to me that someone who's so accomplished and so talented and responsible for so many different really impactful series and films and can be so authentic and just so accessible and so it's really impressive. I spent the first 3 or so weeks just trying to figure out how to be like him, you know, like, but yeah, the process was always really enjoyable. It was a really, really nice experience.
The amount of secrecy that surrounded the project was quite incredible. Was it a frustrating experience to keep that?
It wasn't hard for us to keep it. You know, I remember my first day, we shot at a cemetery about 30 miles outside of LA, so, 35, 40 minute drive outside of LA with no traffic. So it's a commitment to get there. And we were shooting in a chapel that had a big bay window, and we had been given these, like, almost like this, to wear over our costumes when we're walking from our trailers to set. And before the end of the day, JJ came through with his phone and showed me a picture of us in that room that we were standing in that moment that had been taken earlier in the day. I was already online. Mm. So the next day we showed up, this changed to a floor-length vinyl fireman's jacket with a hood, and we had to get into golf carts immediately from our trailers and get zipped into these tarps. We called them the Popemobiles, and all of our base camps wherever we went were surrounded by, obscure, opaque fencing, and it was really, we understood it, because it's like there's this insidious and insatiable desire for people to have information now. They want to know what it's going to be, and I'm like, unfortunately, it's like in this day and age and in our culture, it diminishes the experience. It's like, you think you want to know, but why? It's just going to ruin it for you. So there's a lot of that. But yeah, we took it. I mean, I was excited because now that people know what we look like as these characters, if we do another movie, hopefully we'll be able to walk from our trailers and not worry about it. What do you think?
I was, it's kind of a pain in the ass, but just for, if you got to go to the bathroom, you have to, shoot up.
But the time you didn't suit up?
There was one scene, right after I get accused of cheating and then all that shit happens or whatever. And then we're in that big, huge room and I don't get called up or whatever. And so that was a huge day and required a lot of extras. And I had to go to the bathroom so badly. And the first AD would not let me go out because it required, it was just a lot of preparation for this one shot. So I finally just said, screw it. Ran outside without my cloak and dagger. And
peed against the side.
I think it's fine. I'm relieved. I got to go back inside, finish the day. And then the next day, as I'm getting ready, 5 a.m., it was like the FBI knocked on my door. And it was all the suits. And they said, did you hear about the pictures? And some guy had a telephoto lens by a dirt berm 200 yards away. It was like, it was like Delta Force Recon or something. But I appreciate the secrecy because I appreciate JJ. We talked about him being a magician. He loves magic. Mm-hmm.
And mystery.
I think what he loves about it is exactly that, the mystery, the aha moment, the... He wants to wow people, and I think he wants to protect every part of it. He wants to protect it. He's so aware of the movie experience as a whole, from the first time you hear about it to that second piece of information to what the first trailer. I assure you that every single thing you guys have seen coming up to this moment has been meticulously gone through. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything. How you guys see what the poster looks like, that's all JJ, that he's got his hands in everything. Because he wants that magic experience that I think now has kind of been because of the internet, because of the freedom and the how easily information is dispersed throughout the internet ether. It's that mysteries have been kind of lost, and I appreciated that about him.
Okay, guys, we're
at
time.
Thank you all.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, Jerry, that just about brings us to the end of our podcast today.
Yes, it was quite exciting, really.
It was. And this is almost the very last podcast we'll do about the Star Trek premiere.
Because we hope to have these all out before the premiere actually comes out in Australia on May the 7th.
That's right. And next podcast, we'll actually have the interview that you did, not that I did, that you did with John Cho.
Yes, lovely man. Marlene and I had 15 minutes with him alone. So it's a one-on-one interview.
And John Cho actually plays a part of Sulu.
He does. And I think I've mentioned in my review that it's available on genewsezine.com, genews-ezine.com, and he has the coolest sword.
I can't wait to see that one.
It doesn't give anything away.
So catch us in our next podcast.
Yes, so one-on-one with John Cho.
Bye for now, and join us again when Women Talk Sci-Fi.